Hello, bonjour, Dancy, and welcome to Canuck as a Slur, a podcast about cool, cursed, curious, cringe, clubbing, cranky, car jumping, kid friendly, constitutional, cubic, Quebecois, cooperative, Calgarian, cup winning, Cree, creepy, and kickable Canadian culture and history. I am Kelly, and with me today, well, he may be another one of those filthy, nasty Americans, but we like him anyway. From the Beyond the Breakers podcast, it's Tanner. How are you doing today?
Doing very well. I'm happy to be back on one of my favorite podcasts, Canuck is a Slur.
That's so good to hear. I'm happy to have you here on one of my favorite podcasts, Canuck is a Slur.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to do your plugs up top? Because people tend to get tired but after listening to me specifically.
Sure. So again, I'm Tanner. I am on a podcast called Beyond the Breakers. It is a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. I co-host that with my brother Taylor. We talk, obviously, as the name implies, about shipwrecks, but kind of more generally maritime disasters. Especially lately, we've sort of expanded out to cover some different stuff. We just recently did our first extended Arctic story about a ship called the Carluke. We kind of started out doing stuff in the Great Lakes. That was always kind of the main interest point, and we've sort of branched out from there. But yeah, it's basically just a history podcast through the lens of maritime history, so we can kind of just talk about whatever we want.
Mm-hmm. And what is Taylor's excuse this time around? I don't think I even got one this time.
His excuse. He's on one of his militia training weekends, actually.
Oh, sure.
That's where he's at this weekend. You got to stay ready.
Right-wing militia?
Oh, of course, right-wing militia. Yeah, okay. I mean, that's the only real kind here.
Yeah, these days.
Yeah.
Well, to open up our episode this week, Tanner, how do you feel about sports?
Well, I love sports. I'm wearing a Milwaukee Brewers t-shirt right now. The Brewers play later today. I'm very excited about that. They had the best record in baseball this season. So it's been a magical season. Yeah, I love sports in general. Baseball and American football are the two big ones. Mm-hmm. But I've been known to very occasionally watch sports like basketball or even hockey sometimes.
I mean, you don't have to pander here, but thank you. And we'll breeze past my opinions on baseball because we are here to talk about sports.
I was going to ask you, do you feel anything with the Toronto Blue Jays at all?
No, I have no idea. Are they doing good? Or are they doing bad?
They had the best record in the American League this season. So yeah, they start today because they had a first round bye because they were so good.
Oh, it's fucking playoffs, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Damn. Yep. All right. Well, good for them. My honest opinion is that I don't know, I'm being mean to baseball. Baseball is like fine. I was not raised in it. It's not my thing. Mm-hmm. My oldest brother played it. I think I played one season of T-ball. I feel like it's an atmosphere thing, like going to the ballpark. Like I went to, mm-hmm. my parents are snowbirds and they have a place down in Arizona. So I went to one Arizona Diamondbacks game.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is when they were quite bad. Well, this was 2019. I think they were having a very bad season. But they won this game, and they won it on like a walk-off home run kind of thing. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. So it was like actually quite a good game. And like, yeah, the classic atmosphere of Peanuts and Cracker Jacks and all that shit. Like, for sure. Like, I would probably sit down and watch the World Series and enjoy it. I think I did that once.
Going to a baseball game is a much better experience than going to, say, a football game. It's just basically like a cookout, and there happens to be a game going on.
Yeah.
I was going to say, potentially, as something for your show to investigate, I was thinking about the long-gone Montreal Expos.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was reading a bit about it and how, you know, you don't necessarily associate baseball with Canada, and I think probably even less with French Canada. Mm-hmm. And I was reading a bit about how basically the commentary team, you know, the news coverage teams who covered the Expos sort of had to invent a French lexicon for baseball. Because
that's cool.
It wasn't really something that existed. And so obviously Quebec being one of those places where I know loan words are quite frowned upon. And so trying to work around, how do we say this in French? How do we talk about, you know, a ground rule double in French? I thought that was a cool idea. So I don't know, maybe something you'd want to poke at later on.
Yeah, I feel like Canadian teams basically in the MLB and NBA, being such a minor thing is like something that mm-hmm. has to be covered. Like what was the deal with, you know, the Vancouver Grizzlies and the with the Expos? Like it's But I would be starting from scratch because I know so little. But I do think there is a lot of interesting stuff about the Expos. Probably the only thing I know is that Yuppie was originally their mascot. And when the Expos got moved to, I think it was Washington, they just turned Yuppie into the Canadien mascot. So, but Yuppie's great. I like Yuppie. He's no Gritty, but he's good. Oh, yeah. So the reason I don't realize why I was being hard on baseball is because I was forgetting that the sport I hate is basketball. I think I sometimes conflate them together in my mind, but I fucking hate basketball. So I'm not going to be mean to baseball today. Baseball's fine. Basketball can get in the bin. And of course, we have to do an episode on basketball because it was like, I don't know, heavy quotes, invented by a Canadian. I don't give a fuck. Fuck James Naismith and everything he did. To get to our subject at hand today, we have to take a quick tour through the many and varied ball type games played throughout history. Anywhere in the world, as long as someone has had the means to fashion a ball, be it made from rubber, an animal bladder, or whatever suitable materials might be available, a rowdy group was bound to get together and make a game out of it. These games were very often built around using some combination of feet, hands, sticks to direct the ball, typically towards some kind of goal area. That's like explaining sports to a space alien, right? The sheer variety of games that fall under this broad description across all eras and locations is simply dizzying. Even if you narrow to a specific time and place where we have solid extant accounts of the games being played, you can still find that people did things very differently just one town over. In fact, even just trying to do cursory research and make a concise timeline of how some of these core games crystallized turned out to be overwhelmingly complicated.
Reading the book Baseball in the Garden of Eden, to bring it back to baseball, by John Thorne, it was kind of the same thing. There was almost this dizzying array of variations on the game that we would today call baseball, and it was sort of a state by state, region by region thing. And then eventually it was the New York version that sort of got decided on, this is baseball that we play at, on a national level, and how it was kind of the American Civil War that helped to cement that as the version of the game that got played. But yeah, kind of the same thing, just looking at one sport, the variations within it is really fascinating, especially from a time when there wasn't really, you know, there's no video documentation of these things. There's very little written documentation of these things.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you know that much about the history of baseball, you're probably familiar with how people were like, that's too complicated, and just sort of go with the double day myth.
Right.
To include the, I think it was, I don't know if it's the current, but it was like, it was the baseball commissioner who like himself believed it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. They got together, had a conference and said, we decide that this is what happened. This is how it happened.
Yeah. So you have an idea of maybe the energy we're going to be experiencing today. I had to pull away from the temptation of trying to do a proper history here because it should be noted, I'm not a historian. Instead, we're mostly just going to get some sensible chuckles from someone who was trying to do a proper history. And that is a man named Joseph Strutt, who published this book in 1801. Do you want to read the title for us?
The Sports and Pastimes of the People of England.
The whole title?
I'm trying to make it bigger here.
Okay.
There we go. From the earliest period, including the rural and domestic recreations, May games, mummeries, pageants, processions, and pompous spectacles illustrated by reproductions from ancient paintings, in which are represented most of the popular diversions, by Joseph Strutt, 1801.
I love a good old-timey title. And that's all the time we have for this episode, now that we've read that. I kind of alluded to, in previous episodes of the show, trying to kind of get a consistent theme with our guests. So as you can kind of see, you know, Nicole is a bad vibes hockey guy person. You are becoming my old-timey person. This is the box you're going to be shoved into.
That's cool. That's fine.
Now, in addition to old-timey titles, I personally love a little accidental synchronicity. You may have already noticed this. The 1968 edition that you're seeing here, it has a foreword by none other than Norris and Ross McWhirter, who astute listeners will remember from our Ken Carter series as the publishers of Guinness World Records.
Okay.
Until Ross's untimely death.
Okay.
And later, Norris's much more timely retirement.
Okay, I'm glad you read that, because again, it's kind of small for me, and I thought it said boss. So I'm glad you read it. It says Ross. McWhirter.
Yeah, you're probably getting like a 480p view of the slideshow as well. So the McWhirters are pleased to tell us that, quote, England is fairly and rightly regarded as the cradle of sport, end quote. And I will say this pledge to our UK-based listeners in advance. We are going to get every single accent wrong. I guarantee it.
Absolutely.
I personally think that this assertion is undercut by the book itself. It's pointing to the origins of all these pastimes elsewhere in antiquity, but okay, we'll see. So you may not be able to see this because, like you said, it's a bit grainy for you, but can you see the line there about how there's a new edition? I'll read it for the listeners. It's a new edition, much enlarged and corrected, by J. Charles Cox. We'll come back to this.
J. Charles Cox, I think, right?
Yes. What did I say?
I think you said Carl's.
Okay, it's J. Charles Cox. Yeah, so this is a new edition. This will come into play in a minute. This publication is broken down as a lot of things are in the area. It was published as four books, right? For basically economic reasons. Book 2, Chapter 3, concerns itself with various ball-based games. The book is littered throughout with these sort of, these are old-time illustrations. Like, these are the ones that in 1801, he's pulling up these old illustrations from, like, I think, like the 16th and 17th centuries.
Mm-hmm. They look like kind of your classic sort of European art. It's like right on the cusp of when they sort of like realized what people actually look like and how to depict them in art.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like right there. It still looks very cartoonish with like the proportions. It seems very 2D, but we do see some balls, and at the bottom it's labeled in a nice little script, games with the ball.
Yeah, so up top, like the lady on the right here, I feel like is much like the way people were posed on, you know, what's now cemented as what playing cards look like.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of hands flat and at completely improper angles for any activity, including having a ball clearly thrown at you.
Yeah, she's not going to catch that ball, I don't think.
Yeah. There's another one in the middle here. I don't know if you've ever seen, maybe not if you haven't been to as many fucking electronic music festivals as me, but the kind of people who go around with like just a clear ball and do like weird hand tricks with it. That's what I'm seeing with this person with the ball on the left there. I mean, I don't even know why the people on the right are making those gesticulations. They don't even have a ball near them. I guess they're just saying they're open.
I guess they're exhorting the ball to fly truly. And then at the bottom, it almost looks like the way he's hitting it looks more like golf, but the stick looks more like was it hurling?
Yeah, it's got a real mixed method approach to it. But
he's going to destroy the other guy with that ball also.
Yeah, absolutely. So either very fortunately or very unfortunately, the author frequently refers to these games as ball play. Okay, I'm glad you also find that funny because, you know, due to the combination, like the word play has been co-opted in modern times by, you know, the sex nerds and, you know, me being a child.
We could refer to it as CBT, of course, classic ball tricks.
Great. You basically predicted what the entirety of the script is about. There is mention of a few forms of ball play, including Anglo-Saxon ball play, London ball play, and ball play in France, which Strutt tells us is, quote, called by the French palm play.
Palm as in like an apple?
P-A-L-M.
Oh, palm. I see.
Yeah, palm play. That's what they call ball play in France.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, it really reads like there's a bit of a hanky code situation going on. Yeah, you don't want to be getting into Anglo-Saxon ball play unless you know what you're doing. And like, ideally, if this is like a special venue, you should probably have like medical standby just in case.
You've got to be with someone you trust. That's the most important part, I think.
We also get to learn about edicts against ball playing and notices against ball play by various churches about how, quote, the game of handball was indiscriminately played by both sexes, and so on and so forth.
I mean, I think probably there's this whole thing is probably parallel. I mentioned that baseball in the Garden of Eden and how so much of stuff like sports history is based on restrictions against it. Like what we know about this, you know, game being played, it's like, oh, well, if they were passing, you know, these laws against it, you know, in this municipal code in 1847, then it means that it must predate this by at least a few years. So it's fun how we can sort of reconstruct those histories. In this case, handball or palm play.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you've 100% nailed exactly how it goes just hundreds of years earlier and in Europe. It's Strutt's own efforts to pin down when ball play actually reached Britain's shores. He describes a question of whether one St. Cuthbert engaged in such activities.
St. Cuthbert? Oh, no.
Yeah. He writes that one chronicler, quote, makes no mention of ball play, but tells us he excelled in jumping, running, wrestling, and such exercises as required great muscular exertion. And among them, indeed, it is highly probable that of the ball might be included.
All right. There's allegations.
If you're going to be doing this stuff, I've heard it is important to include the balls, so... With regards to changes in the new edition, so this J. Charles Cox, who is responsible for it, saw fit to add a significant amount of new or updated material, which he helpfully marked with asterisks next to his own entries. Since by his own description, nearly this whole chapter on ball sports was rewritten, going forward, I'm just going to ascribe the written words to the book when it's not clear if the ideas are fully Cox's or just Cox rehashing Strutt's work. Mm-hmm. Aside from the citations of Homer and Herodotus writing of ancient sports, the book also describes tennis as, quote, essentially a French game in its origin, soon domesticated in England. Yeah, which, again, I think this kind of undercuts the whole England as a cradle of sport angle, but whatever.
Yeah, it's like you're, okay, you just told me you took it from somewhere else.
Yeah. Now, on the subject of tennis, we get this delightful example of early sports-related high-stakes trash talk, described as coming from the beginning of the reign of Henry V. Now, I've transcribed this as written, like as it's written in the book.
Okay.
I guess you can read this however you want. I mean, I am fully aware just because the words are spelled differently doesn't mean that the pronunciation is that different. Mm-hmm. However, I think it is much funnier if you try to pronounce them as they're written, mm-hmm. which for me kind of lands with a sort of fake Dutch accent.
Oh, yeah. 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 I do an activity with my students, sometimes where we're talking about the history of English. And so I'll give them a page of Beowulf and I'll ask them, how many words do you recognize? And, you know, they'll find maybe four that they can see that, okay, this is a word I know. And then I'll show them usually like the beginning of the prologue of the Canterbury Tales, like in Middle English. And I'll say, how many words do you recognize? And they recognize, you know, maybe about half. Some of them are spelled different, but they can still see them. And then I'll show them, you know, part of Romeo and Juliet, where they recognize almost every word. And so they can kind of see the progression there of how it's changed. And so when we get to that Middle English, it's always very fun because it's right on the cusp of like, okay, I kind of know this word. This word might be the same word. Like the word flour in that is spelled like we would spell the baking material today, but it's talking about the plant, flour. So yes, I enjoy some good old-timey spellings here.
Yeah, because if I understand this correctly, Middle English is... still pretty unreadable, whereas anything like this is early modern English. Does that sound right? Yeah, okay.
Yes, I would. I mean, this looks like early modern.
Yeah, that's largely where what we have, which coincides kind of when the coverage of these sports emerges. And I did listen to a recording once that someone made of, like a linguist had reconstructed what we believe the accent would have been like to hear Shakespeare performed in its own time. And to me, the accent sounded very, very Irish. Not necessarily a real Irish accent, but like the Lucky Charms Irish accent. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Somewhere between there and Dutch is where I tend to read these, but you're going to have most of these quotes to read. So I feel like it's entirely on you what early modern English sounds like for our purposes.
I'm debating, do I want to actually read that as dolphin or do I want to say like dauphin?
I think whatever's funnier, but I feel like reading it as written, like as though you had no concept that there was an early modern English. Just
all right. I'm gonna do it as written.
Because dauphin is literally just dolphin in French. Like that's what they are calling him. Yeah.
All right. Whilst in the Lent season, the king lay at Kenilworth, there came to him from Charles, dolphin of France, the French king's eldest son, certain ambassadors that brought with them a barrel of Paris balls, which they presented to him for a token from their maester, which present was taken in very ill part, as sent in scorn, to signify that it was more meet for the king to pass the time with such childish exercise than to attempt any worthy exploit. Wherefore, the king wrote to him that, ere aught long, he would send to him some London balls that should break and batter down the roofs of his houses about his ears.
Beautiful.
I think this scene is depicted in the movie The King, the one with Timothy Chalamet and Robert Pattinson.
Okay.
At the beginning, when Henry V has just become king, he gets a gift from, you know, the king of France, and it's this ball that he's supposed to play with because he's a child. It's a nice ball. It's a very nice ball. Any kid would love to have it, but you know, he's the king now. So that's a bit of an insult.
Yeah. like from my reading, that story is probably apocryphal, as they tend to be. It was attested to by at least one chronicler of the time, and then Shakespeare popularized it. It's in Henry the whatever, I think.
Henry V, yeah. Well, and that's the thing about that movie, The King. It is a movie adaptation of the Shakespeare play.
Okay, so I think that was coming up when I was reading it.
Yeah,
so probably not true, but just very fun to imagine somebody sending you, you know, the Paris balls and be like, I'll show you my London balls, and also that's me killing you. Like,
it's already over. It's too late. I've already depicted myself as the barrel of Paris balls and you as the barrel of London balls.
In another passage, we're told of a toddler that was supposedly killed in the 15th century from being hit by a tennis ball. To save some time, this is also pretty well understood to be a myth, but in trying to verify whether anyone had ever been killed by a tennis ball, wading past, of course, some confused LLM slop and a very unfunny attempt at a fake news blog, there is one example from 1983 when a tennis linesman was struck so forcefully by a serve to his groin that he fell backward out of his umpire's chair, struck his head on the ground, and later died from his injuries. Mm. That sucks.
Okay. I didn't think the only attested death by tennis ball was going to be from the 1980s. I was thinking you were going to pull something out of like the 1800s.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I had thought like, okay, if they're making them with something harder back then, no, I don't think this has ever happened. I do not think you can be killed directly by a tennis ball. However, you can be killed indirectly by a tennis ball.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, of course.
In the nut. So it's like you knew it hurt while you were falling, right? Like. As a palate cleanser for that, here is a delightful illustration of the young Duke of York at tennis. It has nothing to do with anything we're talking about.
Oh, that's a fancy boy. That's a very fancy boy right there.
Do you want to describe what we're seeing for the listeners?
It's labeled the highborn Prince James, Duke of York. Did they have to label him highborn?
Of course they do.
I feel like it's kind of assumed. Also, I'm assuming this is James, Duke of York, as in the future James II.
I think so.
So yeah, he's a fancy lad. He's in his tennis outfit. It looks, I don't know, I think it's just the depiction, but it looks like he is wearing like a breastplate or something. It's like a padded jacket, I think, is what he's wearing.
Yeah, it's got very straight lines.
His outfit has a bunch of, it has frills at the cuffs. It has like a frill around the neck. It's not, it's got frills at the end of the pant legs. He's wearing some fairly high boots, not what I would think of as a tennis playing outfit. It looks like high heels on those boots. I think you would really fuck up your ankle trying to play tennis in this.
Oh, I'm sure you're one of those kids these days who doesn't respect the traditions. That doesn't even wear frills on his tennis outfit. God, get out of my rec center.
Yeah. I don't think this would fly at one of the modern tennis tournaments, honestly. Yeah. Also the racket's really funny because the handle is super short. It's got a handle the size of like a ping pong, racket. But then the head of the racket is like the same size. It's a very funny looking racket.
This is going to be a theme throughout a lot of what we're going to talk about, but I would just love to see, I don't know, a YouTube channel where they just try to reconstruct these old games. Maybe this exists, but with the original materials and dimensions and stuff and trying to play them and seeing if they suck ass, because spoiler, a lot of these games really seem to suck ass. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that photo has nothing to do with anything we're talking about, but it was the one photo from these chapters that I didn't attach to something we're talking about. I'm like, well, we can't not show this little fancy boy.
The picture's also funny because it's a bit unclear what he's supposed to be doing. He doesn't seem to be like in the process of hitting a ball. He's sort of looking at the viewer, so he's clearly not prepared to return a ball that's coming at him. It's just kind of like a generic action-y shot.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some themes recurring from the other images we saw of, like, we haven't quite figured out how to draw people. Like, the people in the background kind of look like they're, like, appalled as though somebody has been murdered on the tennis court, but...
They're shocked that he's wearing the frills. It's like, you can't come on the court like that.
The text later tells of another death, that of Frederick, Prince of Wales, who died in 1751 of what modern historians believe was a pulmonary embolism following a respiratory illness. This flies in the face of a series of legends. For example, the BBC tells us that the myth is of him dying from being struck in the head by a cricket ball. The tall tale that finds its way into our book here, however, is that a contemporary autopsy revealed what appeared to his physicians to be a ruptured abscess, or an imposthume had broken in like the old-timey parlance. The physicians of the time ascribe this to being caused by, quote, the blow of a tennis ball 3 years before.
I mean, props to whoever served that ball. That's a pretty solid shot.
Again, probably not true.
Well, they mention a cricket ball also. I I've never handled a cricket ball. I assume it's fairly hard.
I don't think they're too far off from a baseball. I think they're... Yeah, I mean, a cricket ball is more plausible, I think, almost at any point in history. Mm-hmm. But the hit by a ball 3 years ago is just a very funny... Like, sometimes I feel like the old-timey physicians, like, were just making up the most ridiculous shit they could on purpose to see what people would believe. I don't know. Another interesting piece of trivia from this era, a test to a game played in 1516 between the Marquis of Dorset, who played with his palm, and the King of Castile, who played with a recently invented racket. So this is a good example of the varying rule sets of the time having extremely blurred lines, right? Even as late as 100 years later, the game is still described as having the rackets being optional and the court still themselves vary wildly in size.
That would be a cool variation on modern tennis, if you could just like choose something else to play with.
Yeah.
Or nothing at all.
I think that speaks to how shitty the rackets were back then, that like the palm still might have just been better.
Would be just as good. Yeah.
I think if you try to play tennis today without a racket, you're like, this is not working. Now, the last time we're going to mention tennis today is just so you can read another terrific piece of early modern English text.
I have it from this nobleman's mouth that lately the Duke of Norfolk and my lord, I assume.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah. Did you want me to help you with any of the abbreviations?
My lord of Leicester were playing at tennis, the queen beholding them, and my lord, Robert.
Yeah, I think so. I asked around for this and people told me it's probably Lord and Robert. And yeah, Queen is pretty obvious.
The QAnon.
What does it all mean?
My Lord Robert, being very hot and sweating, took the Queen's napkin out of her hand and wiped his face, which the Duke seeing, said that he was too... said that he was too saucy and swore that he would lay his racket upon his face. Hereupon rose a great trouble, and the queen offended sore with the duke.
I'm really impressed with how good you are reading early modern English, because I'm just sitting there enunciating every word where I'm like, very hot and sweating.
Well, it's funny because like talking about that, like talking about with students and how like the changes are such that like, even in these like early modern or like even some of the middle English texts, it's like, if you just look at them on paper, it's like you might not get it, but reading it out loud, you suddenly recognize, oh, this is this word. I know this word.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, you're also more charitable than I am with the early modern English people, because I just like to imagine they have a head injury. That's just how they talk back then. You are too saucy.
Being very, very hot and sweating.
And I am sorry for this, but we do have one more quick example of ecclesiastical rules concerning ball play. Mm-hmm. In the mid-1600s, it appears that the level of palm and ball play was getting out of hand in one particular monastic order. It was happening all over their cloisters and church roofs. Mm. Yeah, that's a real problem. So they had a general chapter, which I guess is just sort of like a meeting to convene their rules, in 1559, and they expressly forbade this sort of thing in sacred places and cemeteries. If you gotta have some ball play, please keep it out of the cemetery.
I would prefer you didn't do the ball play at all, but...
if you must.
I'm a realist. I understand. Just keep it out of the cemetery. Keep it out of the cloisters.
Yeah, that is exactly what this next quote is. So this is from 80 years later. It's the same order. They just revised the rules. So this is Joseph Strutt's words in 1801.
The chapter laid down the wise principle that man, however religiously he lived, was still man, and that therefore it was not prudent to deny him honest and moderate relaxation, which might prove service to his soul as well as his body.
Mm.
They adopted, however, this precautionary measure, that in houses where ball play was allowed, it was only to be permitted in some secluded place to which no secular person could gain access.
Again, ball, I understand, you are still man, you need honor, honest and moderate relaxation. We will allow ball play, but you cannot do it where like your parishioners can see you.
This is the same talk that the UW Madison police officer gave us. I remember at orientation saying like, hey, we're not kicking down doors to catch you drinking in your rooms. If you're going to drink underage, drink in your room. That's all we ask. This is the same thing with ball play.
Yeah. The officers didn't say anything to you about ball play?
I mean, I'm sure
you didn't go to Brigham Young, but
I'm sure if pressed on the issue, they probably would have had some advice for us.
Hmm. The book also covers some similar games played against a wall. The game of fives played with the palms, the game of bat fives, which modified it with wooden bats, and finally the game of rackets, which we would consider the direct predecessor to the game of squash, which much more recently begat racquetball. The whole set of games earns considerably less interest from the 1903 publisher Cox, who writes in his conclusion on the Game of Rackets, quote, "With its later history, we are not concerned, nor with the various developments of the present Game of Fives, which is essentially a pastime for boys."
Yeah,
fuck fuck you, Wall Sports. We also get an unfortunately brief description of Windeball or Balloon, credited by the book to the Romans and its origins, and yet little information is given on its history or rules, other than being, quote, "tossed to and fro with a fist in the open air," end quote. We do, however, get a wonderfully verbose endorsement of what I think is a description of a full body workout. I think that's what they're trying to say.
"The wind ball or yarn ball between three or four shall not be inutile," that's a fun word, "to be used in a place convenient, each keeping their limit. For tossings, wherein may be a very profitable exercise, because at all times they keep not the like force in striking, so that shall be constrained to use more violent stretching with swifter moving at one time than another, which will make the exercise more nimble and deliver both of hand and whole body, therefore increasing of heat through swift moving in all parts the sooner."
Here I'm briefly going to skip ahead a few sports to cover the end of the chapter, and then we're going to work our way back. We're going to pick up at the first mention of golf, and again, this is traced directly to Roman origins, and many paragraphs later, it is sort of vaguely concerned that, yes, maybe the Scottish can have some credit for this. It's probably worth mentioning, on that note, that these publishers see fit to refer to Edinburgh as a Scotch town rather than a Scottish city. Yeah, this came up recently as a point of discussion on our Discord, which everyone can join for free, by the way, where our resident true Scotsman noted the generally pejorative use of the term Scotch as something being largely employed by, in his words, so of course I'm going to do the correct accent, "a certain type of English person." That was awful.
Yeah, I mean, Scotch, aside from obviously the drink, but I feel like I only ever hear the term Scotch when people are describing like the large portion of Americans who have Scotch-Irish ancestry.
Yes, this was also something that came up in this discussion, was like, it feels very normalized to North Americans where we just go like, oh, I haven't seen a lot of Scotch. I feel like people maybe in Canada use like Scots more. But yeah, to a Scottish person, he was like, no, this is a pejorative used by that type of English person. So
yeah, I think of the term Scotch as like a descriptor, kind of the same way that like we used to call people from Switzerland Switzers. Like that's where Switzerland comes from in English.
Interesting.
And it's like using that today, it's like, okay, I kind of know what person you're talking about, but that's not what we call them.
Also worth remembering, again, this book was heartily endowed by, or sorry.
Hardly
does. It's worth remembering on that note. The book is heartily endowed, but it was also heartily endorsed by the McWhorter twins, both noted Tories, at least one of whom famously had stances on the Irish I think we can call highly problematic. So maybe take all that into context.
With the Mick names, there's a very good possibility that they're like Ulster Scots in background. Maybe. I could be reaching there.
They were just English, I think.
Okay.
Golf, as it's actually described here, it's not really alien to how you would probably describe golf today. Like, it's a game that is not necessarily wildly
like
evolved.
It sucks.
Like, it's like, all right, we've got to hit the ball toward the hole as few times as possible. Like, that has not changed. Like, the golf course has changed, but golf itself is, like, really what it comes down to when it comes to this script. Is there anything funny? No, we're skipping it. Okay. But one big particular interest. So our attention is going to get drawn to this illustration. It's in the middle of this slide. You may have to embiggen that one a little bit. I'll kind of describe. So you've got somebody doing a sweeping motion with their golf club. Some people just kind of standing around. It looks like they're all in the green. They're standing around and pointing. Like, I don't know. I feel like if you've already finished, you got to get the fuck off the green. And then you've got someone like down kneeling trying to play. So the caption, as the book phrases it, is, quote, "the figure down on his knees is holing." Okay. Suddenly I'm interested in golf now.
What does the top caption say?
I think it says something fives, maybe glove fives.
Glove fives.
Because they're playing it with like gloves and not bare hands, but not with bats either, if I had to guess.
And then the middle one says golf, and the bottom one says
I think this is Stanley Effigy at Elford. I believe that is the kid who, according to myth, died from a tennis ball. And the one of the reasons that myth, if I remember correctly, persisted was that you see how it's like touching the side of its face. Mm-hmm. This was like wildly interpreted by, I don't know, the proto archaeologists essentially, or anthropologists, as saying like, oh, well, that's obviously because that's, he's touching the spot where he died. That's what it symbolizes. But then, and it's like, oh, and he's holding a tennis ball. And then I can't remember the real reasons, but it's something along the lines of like, oh, he's actually holding an apple and like he's touching his face because it's some sort of Christian thing. I don't know.
His left arm looks to be covering his balls also. Like he is concerned he's going to get hit in the balls by this ball.
Yeah, maybe this kid actually did die from getting hit in the balls with a tennis ball as well. Fell over and smashed his head.
Little does he know that much like Achilles, that is not the part that's going to be a problem. It's going to hit him in the chin and it's going to kill him 3 years later.
Yeah, that's pretty much all we get on golf that's worth our attention, as the book tells us, because they don't give us as much on golf. And their explanation is, quote, much more might be recorded of the early history and development of golf in Scotland, but that would not be in accord with the work on the sports and pastimes of the people of England.
Oh,
yeah. That just real good type of old, tiny, granular xenophobia. You just don't get it anymore. So after that, we can move on to the sport of cricket. It's a pretty lengthy section of the chapter. And again, basically nothing in it is funny. So we're just going to go ahead and skip most of it. But appended to the end of cricket, you get a quick description of some similar bat-based games. So we've got some more images here. I particularly love the, I think it's a pitcher in the middle row there.
Uh-huh.
Who is sort of doing a, what's that like fighting game thing? Like the Hadouken or whatever?
Yeah, he's, you can imagine both of these characters like rocking back and forth with their like idle animations.
Yes, this is a freeze frame of the most like awkward looking frames of an idle animation where it's like, well, it looks good when it's moving. It looks stupid when you pause it.
This is like a draft version of Tekken or something. The guy, maybe, I can't tell if that's supposed to, I assume it's supposed to be a guy holding the ball. Is he also holding like, is that supposed to be a bat? Cause it looks like a trumpet. It looks like a horn of some kind.
You mean
kind.
Up top or in the bottom?
No, the middle one.
Oh, I think it's a bat. Yeah.
Okay.
I think this is a sort of throw your own pitch and hit it. And then the other person has to catch it.
Okay. Like, you know, you're doing, you're taking grounders in like baseball practice.
Maybe
okay.
Something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of other bat based games. One is, if this is old enough, I think maybe you have to pronounce the KN, Knurren spell, kind of an Anglo-Saxon areas here. Mm-hmm. And at least one location had the terrific name for this, potty knocking.
Frowned upon in most places now.
Yeah. Well, it was a different time. And finally, we're teased by quick little aside that on at least two occasions, people have tried to play cricket on horseback. It's something I desperately want to see. In fact, like I think we should be trying equestrian versions of every sport.
I do imagine like a certain level of, you know, upper middle to upper class English person, like just having a bunch of horses around saying we might as well incorporate these. They probably want to play too.
But why can't we apply that to, you know, I don't know, ice hockey? Have we tried it?
You'd have to ride on like a, I don't know, an elephant seal or something that can navigate the ice a little bit better.
I guess so. All right, so doubling back to the what we skipped over, we get to the all-important category, hurling, hockey, camp ball. This is where things start to get confusing with the inclusion of a section from the original author, Strutt, that the publisher Cox feels he has to clarify. If you're familiar with the modern sport of hurling, Strutt's original description is actually going to sound much more to us like a game of rugby football. First off, he posits that it's, in his words, a species of the handball, and he traces it back to the Roman harpastum. So put a pin in that term for now. It then goes on to identify two distinct versions dating back to the early 17th century. There's hurling to goals. Just an extra E in goals there. So hurling to goals is played in eastern Cornwall, and hurling to the country has played in western Cornwall.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. And we all know which side we're on.
Some divides can never be healed.
That's true. Yeah. When I went to, I went to East Cornwall and they were like, don't go to West Cornwall, man. Don't go over there.
It's you heard not, about what they do over there?
Yeah. So Strutt cites a writer from back in the early 17th century who wrote,
for hurling to goals, there are 15, 20, or 30 players, more or less, chosen out on each side, who strip themselves to their slightest apparel and then join hands in rank one against another. So far, it sounds like Red Rover. Out of these ranks, they match themselves by pairs.
Pairs.
One embracing another, and so pass away every...
R.I.P.
Oh no, this is a terrible game. Every of which couple are especially to watch one another during the play. So we're incorporating some voyeurism here.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Yeah, and then it goes on. It describes like pretty much what you would expect from a rudimentary field. And then it continues.
Whosoever can catch and carry through his adversary's goal hath won the game. But herein consisteth one of Hercules' his labors. For he that is once possessed of the ball hath his contrary mate waiting at inches, and assaying to lay hold upon him. The other thrusteth him in the breast with his closed fist to keep him off, which they call butting.
Right. So the rules seem to suggest this kind of strict man-to-man coverage, if anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's a ruler that the hurler, quote, must not butt nor handfast under the girdle. It also prohibits forward passing.
Okay. So I can see the rugby connection there.
Yeah. So like at BYU, the cops are definitely telling you no hand fasting under the girdle.
Absolutely. Butting was developed as a way around some of those restrictions.
Yeah.
But they're cracking down on that too.
People say it's a myth, but I've seen it. My cousin told me about it. Right. So when it comes to hurling to the country, we get a suggestion of essentially the same rules scaled up. It's teams made of multiple parishes with goals consisting of houses or even entire towns miles apart, with no regard for pairing up players or even counting numbers of players. And Strutt continues with that same writer's words.
The hurlers take their next way over hills, dales, hedges, ditches, yea, and through bushes, briars, mires, plashes, and rivers whatsoever. So as you shall sometimes see 20 or 30 lie tugging together in the water, scrambling and scratching for the ball.
Yeah, let's go down to the water and just do some tugging with 30 of our closest homies.
Hey, everybody grab your partner and let's go tug in the water.
And then Strutt shares, he's seen some Irish folks playing hurling with, of all things, a club? Now, this is cause for Cox to jump in. So Cox is the publisher, or the re-author, essentially, to jump in and attempt to clarify by using the words of another writer who said, quote, Shinty in Scotland, hockey in England, and hurling in Ireland appear to be very much the same out-of-door sport, end quote. He also invokes a 1527 statute from Galway, which prohibits, quote, the hurling of the little ball with hockey sticks or staves, end quote. Cox claims that this is the first recorded appearance of the word hockey and cites one dictionary as equivocating hockey with shinty and bandy. Now, it's at this stage I'd like you to look at these illustrations here. Specifically, the one in the bottom right, it features two participants with crossed clubs or sticks.
Yeah.
The publishers, Cox, tells us that this is a 14th century illustration, which was originally labeled as golf, but like he suspects this is actually bandy or hockey.
Oh, golf would be so much cooler if that's what it looked like.
Yeah, like that's Happy Gilmore golf.
Two guys swinging at the same ball in opposite directions. That would be cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, this looks like a hockey face-off.
All right, so to summarize, we have clear overlap between golf and bandy as well as hockey, which has clear overlap with shinty and Irish hurling, which shares a name with Cornish hurling. That's the one described as descending from handball, yet sounds intriguingly similar to rugby football. But today, Irish hurling has many shared rules and field dimensions with Gaelic football. So is everything crystal clear so far?
Absolutely.
All right. So outside of this book, I've seen an unsighted claim that Irish and Cornish hurling are completely unrelated, but also other unsighted claims that Irish hurling, Cornish hurling, and the game of La Soule, largely played in areas of northern France that have a great deal of shared cultural and linguistic history, that's namely Picardy, Normandy, and Brittany, these all derive from common ancestry. My personal opinion is that latter seems a little more likely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the subject of La Soule, I spent a little time combing through a sports history published in 1901, around the time of the update to Strutt's book. It's Les Sports et Jeux d'Exercice dans l'Ancienne France. So it's basically like same thing, but for France.
Mm-hmm.
The author of this one parenthetically terms La Soule alternatively as ballon au pied, or literally ball with foot. And this is in reference to a French statute by Philip VI, and he was just kind of broadly banning sports in 1319.
Mm-hmm. So I'm American, so when you say ball with foot, this is probably a game where you spend most of the game with the ball in your hands, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
What else would it be? Because interestingly, so this is the same French text. They're describing a letter from the English King Edward III. So they're actually referring now to an English statue. They're just talking in French. So this is a letter that Edward III sent to like local sheriffs. Mm-hmm. And the French text refers to that ban. And it's like kind of just lumping them together. It says de ballon à la main ou au pied. So in other words, like, well, handball or football. Mm. When you see this in modern English, they'll just say like handball and football is two distinct sports, I guess, in a category that's like in there with hockey. Mm-hmm. But originally it's actually written in Latin. And the sport is also termed on its own as pedaeum. Again, this has not cleared up anything.
Hello, listener, and welcome to the Midreel ad. If you enjoy Canuck is a Slur, a podcast about Canadian culture, and you want to hear more of it more often, there is an option. The Canuck is a Slur Patreon. Signing up at any tier gets you access to Give Kelly Your Money. And joining an elevated tier gets you access to monthly bonus episodes. If that sounds good, you can sign up at www.patreon.com/Canuck is a Slur. And now, back to the episode.
I do want to just add, like, Edward III, it is very funny to think of, like, the various concerns in his brain at any given time. One of them is, like, claiming his rightful throne in France to kick off the Hundred Years' War. And then he's also thinking about, we got to stop with the ball games.
But these are more related than you might think. So do you know what the justification is much of the time for banning games? So I think it's the same justification in both of these cases, in France and in England.
Is it a matter of like, hey, you athletic boys slash men should be using your prowess elsewhere in a more productive way?
Right. And what prowess would be more productive if you need to go to war?
Maybe in my army and or like providing supplies to my army.
Or even just specifically, like you should be doing archery. If you're going to be training yourself in sports.
If you're going to practice something, it might as well be something useful.
Yeah, like archery is repeatedly cited as like these are idle games. If you are able-bodied and like mucking around, you should be mucking around with a bow so that you are going to be a deadlier warrior.
Because I'm telling you, boys, there's going to be this thing called Agincourt, and you are going to wish that you spent less time on the ball field and more time at the archery range.
Yeah, exactly that. I think in the longer French quote, it doesn't mention Agincourt, maybe because the French writer is too embarrassed to even mention that. But it's like, it ties this to like this, you know, there's no coincidence that we had these defeats at these other battles. I can't remember which ones they were, but I feel like it's just very much this medieval grind set of like, bro, if you are not out there doing archery, you are falling behind. You are going to lose in war. These are games for boys. Yeah. So that's very much the basis of these bans, at least at these two examples, I think. Mm-hmm. In other examples, there is more to do with like they're banning it over like just social disturbance and shit like that. Or just because a king doesn't like it, you know.
A lot of the ones with the baseball ones were like, it's forthwith unlawful to play on the village green within 100 yards of the city hall or whatever. It's like, because we've been breaking too many windows.
Yeah, there's a lot of complaints from like the wall games and stuff, like the Jeu de Paume or the fucking like fives, mm-hmm. because you keep breaking the church windows. So the updated version of the book, like this is the one that I have. It does a great job of explaining why these centuries old games are so hard to disentangle. So this is Cox's words.
All games with ball have a tendency to change and mingle with others, and very much in different districts, as well as at different periods. Hence, it is difficult to keep their nomenclature accurate and distinct. The true Cornish hurling, and a like game in other parts of England, seems to have consisted in the hurling or hand throwing of a comparatively small ball. An interesting but unfortunately brief reference to this Western game as a sport between counties occurs as early as 1648. Quote, "The counties of Devon and Cornwall are, on Monday next, to meet at a hurling, a sport they have with a ball."
Yeah, helpful.
Well, I like that this is like the earliest one is 1648. It's like they got the English Civil War out of the way, the first one at least, so that they could like finally get back to hurling.
But like it's consistent with, I mean, everyone kind of knows the very famous soccer truce in 1914, I think Christmas was. As you're kind of going through a lot of old timey sports photos, you'll see these things of like, yeah, people were on leave from trenches in World War One, and just like the people who had legs or didn't have trench foot are like, yeah, we're going to play some rugby and smash into each other.
I think last week, Vanderbilt University, they had some statistic where their quarterback threw for the last time a quarterback had thrown for that many yards for Vanderbilt was 1918. And the quarterback was a guy who died after getting shot down in France. So it's like, that's how historic this football program is.
Oh, wow. Now, you might recall that there were three sports named in this section's heading. Hurling, hockey, camp ball. Mm-hmm. Strutt says this last term derives from the Anglo-Saxon camp, meaning combat. But for maybe better, broader context, there's a ton of words across like Romance languages and I think a little bit of Germanic languages. And they all seem to kind of basically boil down etymologically from the Latin campus, which is like from the earlier Greek campos. So the Latin term, from my understanding, I'm not a Latin expert. I mean, you're the Latin expert, could be used to mean anything from a plain to a level surface to an open space used for battle or games. Mm-hmm. Now, from this, we get a ton of words all related to open spaces, competition, and or war. So these include camping, campaign, champion. Like, they all come from that. Mm-hmm. So however we got there etymologically, it's actually a pretty apt term. This game is very violent and best suited to open spaces. So the 1903 publication pegs this game of camp ball to Eastern Cornwall. Mm. And for experts who are keeping track, that is where the dominant form of hurling was to goalless. Mm. So that this game was sort of a rough equivalent to the Western game of hurling to the country. So in the west, you have hurling to the country, in the east, you have hurling to goals, but then they have this camp ball game, which looks a lot like hurling to the country. Mm. Maybe we're not so different.
We're not. I mean, again, like with baseball, it's like that's sort of how the modern rules get hashed out is you suddenly have people coming together in these big camps for the Civil War, and you have them sort of, well, are we playing Massachusetts style? Are we playing New York style? What are we going to do here? And then sort of picking pieces from both.
Yeah, I'm confident in like 100 years tops, we're going to figure out whether you can have a designated hitter or not.
Personally, I love the universal designated hitter in baseball. I think it was a wonderful change that really, really helped the game.
I have no opinion. I just know that was there until like, what, 5 years ago? 2 years
Nobody
ago?
Wants to watch the pitcher bat unless it's like, there's like three pitchers you would want to see do that.
Right. That sounds right. No, I do. It does sound like a good rule.
Yeah.
So this game, camp ball, was still played in a relatively confined area of about 150 to 200 yards, but you know, like hurling to the country, there didn't really seem to be a restriction on how they hit each other or how many might pile on, right? As opposed to hurting to the goals where it's like 1-to-1. Mm-hmm. The goals were, in classic East Cornish fashion, quote, formed of the thrown off clothes of the competitors, end quote. That's the description. The updated editor is quoting from an 1823 source. So it was after the first author died.
That sounds like a guy who just wanted to have everyone take their clothes off and is like, hey, what are we going to use for the goals, guys? I don't know. I have no idea.
But it just goes to show the intense homoeroticism of sports is nothing new. And once a neutral party had thrown the ball in between the two lines of competitors, they just smash into each other to try to get initial control.
That sounds like rugby. Okay.
Yeah. And so then here's how the gameplay is described. So this is, again, this 1823 source that the modern updated authors are quoting.
If caught and held, he throws the ball, but must in no case give it to a comrade who, if it be not arrested in its course or be jostled away by his eager foes, catches it and hurries home, winning the notch or snotch if he continues to carry, not throw it between the goals. A holder of the ball, caught with it in his possession, loses a snotch. At the loss of each of these, the game recommences after a breathing time. 7 or 9 snotches are the game, and these it will sometimes take 2 or 3 hours to win. At times, a large football was used, and the game was then called kicking camp, and if played with shoes on, was termed savage camp.
Oh no. What were you doing with your shoes?
Oh no.
I'm going to be honest with you. When I first read this quote, I spent so long trying to understand. I thought notch and snotch were two different types of scores in this game.
Right. That sounds like that's very like Harry Potter coded. It sounds like.
Yeah, a little bit. It's like, yeah, it's like 15 notches to a snotch. But if you get the snotch, the game ends. But I also would I'm like, OK, it's just snotches. It's like, or they're alternate names, I guess, for the same goal. And I'm like, notch makes more sense to my modern brain, because when I see snotch, I'm just thinking like, oh yeah, like, call me fucking Jay and Silent Bob the way I'm playing this snotchy botchy.
Yeah, and these early games are so interesting, like trying to research the histories of them, because it's like a lot of them are very much just like ad hoc. How many people do we have? How much time do we have? How long do we want to play? Are we playing 7 innings or 9? Are we playing with 13 people or 11 people? However many we have is how many we're going to play with.
There's a little bit of that too, I think, informally when you play games today. If you're going to be playing, I just keep thinking of ping pong or even, beer pong, pickleball, whatever. You'd be like, how much do we have time? Like, you want to go to 7, you want to go 11, you want to go to 15? Mm-hmm. Like, that happens pretty often.
Yeah, I mean, like, any like, you know, you play a pickup football game as a kid, it's like, you would very, very rarely have, you know, 11 on 11. Like, no, right. You never have that many people, so you're going to play, you know, 5 on 5 or something.
Yeah. So, on the subject of kicking camp / savage camp, if you can believe it, an 1892 source states that this game fell out of favor due to, quote, numerous and fatal accidents.
Also, it's like you have a choice this summer. You can go to space camp or you can go to savage camp.
Yeah. We have another wrinkle of confusion added here because Strutt originally wrote that he believed camp ball to be, quote, only another denomination for football, end quote, to which the publisher said wrong.
Okay.
But their opinion is this conflation. It might stem from something as early as the first ever English to Latin dictionary. And that had an entry for the English word campan, C-A-M-P-A-N, alternatively defined as a player at football. So that's how they write it in this book. So I checked the citation for the same dictionary, and it says, okay, there's a word campar, C-A-M-P-A-R, which means player with an E at football, one word.
Mm.
So again, I cannot tell what is even true.
Okay.
Now, what might come as a surprise here is Strutt didn't have a ton to say about games termed football because, as he put it in 1801, it was a formerly popular game that had, quote, fallen into disrepute and is but little practiced, end quote. He wasn't the only one to say this. A publication called The Sporting Magazine wrote only a year later, quote, football is fast going out and leapfrog is now the full sport of the day. And that's why we have so many versions of leapfrog today that people can't agree on.
I'm trying to think, like, is leapfrog even a game? Like, our version of, like, what we would think of as leapfrog. It's just like something, it's like an activity. It's not really a game.
Right?
It's like,
like, maybe if your leg touches the person, you lose? Or you're not actually supposed to use hand? Because to me, leapfrog is like you put your hands on someone's shoulders and leap over.
Yeah.
Maybe you were not allowed to use hands. It's sort of like a limbo contest. I don't know. I to be honest, I could not afford to get another tangent. I'm like, I'm not looking up the history of leapfrog, but that'll be an exercise for the listener or viewer. Right. So that's what Strutt says. And then Cox makes a point of proclaiming, well, there's like a lot of progress has been made in a century, but then a lot of the anecdotes that he inserts into the text to kind of essentially fluff out the football section a little more, because Strutt wrote almost nothing. So let's review a couple of my favorites here. So this is from a political treatise? How do I say that?
I've always said treatise.
Okay. From a political treatise in 1531, quote, nothing but beastly fury and extreme violence, whereof proceedeth hurt, and consequently rancor and malice do remain with them that be wounded, wherefore it is to be put in perpetual silence.
I like that your early modern English voice sounds a lot like your voice from Chili Beach.
Yeah, the main guy?
Yeah.
Ooh, if we could just go out and play a little football.
From a Puritan pamphlet in 1583, devilish pastime, and hereof groweth envy, rancor, and malice, and sometimes brawling, murder. I love that spelling of it. Murder, homicide, and a great effusion of blood, as experience daily teacheth.
Not just murder and homicide.
Murder and homicide.
But I mean, it's telling. These are 50 years apart and both people agree, for sure. Rancor and malice. There's no question. We also get two fascinating tragedies here. The first is a tale of two men named William, one a monk, one a layman. Really sounds like a setup to a bar joke. So these two are playing each other in a game in 1321. The layman, it is said, was seriously injured when he collided with the monk who was in the process of kicking the ball. And would you like to guess the nature of his injury?
He had a dislocated kneecap.
Not quite. The monk, quote, was carrying a sheathed knife in his girdle, which was... And this was apparently enough to injure the layman so badly that he died, in their words, within 6 days.
I mean, back then, though, it's like every little cut could get infected and kill you.
100%.
Like,
but can you imagine, like, you get stabbed playing soccer and then you go home and you're playing proto-mob football and you go home and you're laying there on your straw bed, and your wife is like, "Oh, were you playing, you know, footing ball again? Were you playing with knives again?" And you're like, "Oh my God, get off my back." And it like takes you 6 days of that to die.
And then also like maybe just not wanting to admit that you got killed by a monk.
Yeah.
That's kind of embarrassing.
So William de Spalding, who is the monk here, he had to apply directly for papal dispensation to be absolved of a crime and allowed to return to his clerical duties. Like, I don't know how much that is like, you know, if you write to someone and like their office just sends back a rubber stamp, or like the Pope had to review this himself. I really hope it's the latter.
It's like, we were playing ball and I accidentally killed a guy, but it wasn't like immediate. So it's not really my fault. Totally.
I think that there is like text of the papal dispensation. It says something like, well, the guy definitely felt bad. So like we're pretty sure he didn't try to. And the other guy ran into him. So stuff like that. I was trying to fact check that against another source. And so I come across an incident, this one's from 1508, in which a player is accidentally killed when he fell onto his own knife.
Okay, this is why you can't carry a knife in the modern NFL anymore. So
yeah, because of woke, you can't even play football with a knife. I don't know. I mean, we shouldn't judge. The guy might have been Sikh, and it's actually going to be very, very,
but again,
very racist of us to judge him.
I guess, however, we are thinking of it the modern conception of these games that are very heavily regulated. Back with these, it legitimately was a more violent pastime. You might have needed that knife, you know, if something comes, if there's a benches clearing brawl in camp ball in 1520. Yeah, you probably are going to want to bring a knife.
Maybe there's one I didn't keep in. There was a guy who literally, like, this was a like a criminal proceeding because he killed another guy in the middle of one of these games with a rock. He just smashed him in the head. So like that shit did happen. And it's actually, so it's somewhere, I think it's honestly comes up a few times within all of this like web of like village mob game people play, where they're like, basically the only route. The only rule is you can't murder people. Like, they did put it in as a rule.
Okay, that certainly is a double major penalty a thing in hockey?
I mean, you can have a 10-minute misconduct. So yeah, I think it's that.
I think that would warrant a 10-minute misconduct probably.
Yeah. He's been fined $5,000, a maximum allowable under the CPA, for murdering the other player. next one is even more eyebrow raising in its presentation. So the quotation contained in this quote is just like, it's another writer being cited by Cox in his version.
After the dissolution of the monasteries, when Sir Roger Townsend was pulling down the tower of Coxford Priory, Norfolk, to build himself a goodly house, the steeple came down with a crash and fell upon a house nearby, breaking it down and slaying one Mr. Seller, that lay blame in it of a broken leg gotten at football.
Not sure that counts as a football death, if I'm being honest. if I'm doing some source criticism.
He would not have been laid up like that without the football. So sure, we could tangentially, certainly an accessory to this death.
Yeah, but that's such Looney Tunes shit. Most of the rest of what the text has to say here concerns a long history of football, like many other games discussed, being banned by various edicts and statutes over the years, although the book hastens to mention it's quite likely that they were not necessarily that well enforced. So one piece of evidence given, we have a complaint from an academic in 1634, and he's complaining about what appears to be the proliferation of two different games that he, I guess, resents equally.
I would now make a safe retreat, but that methinks I'm stopped by one of your heroic games called football, which I conceive, under your favor, not very conveniently civil in the streets, especially in such irregular and narrow roads as Crooked Lane. Yet it argues your courage, much like your military pastime of throwing at cocks, since you have long allowed these two valiant exercises in the streets.
Yeah, Crooked Lane, I guess, not just a clever name. That's what it says on the tin. Well, if you're wondering what throwing at cocks could be, have you heard of throwing at cocks?
Not in this capacity.
Okay. The book has an entry for it. It's a different chapter from the one we've been working out of. So just kind of refreshing here. This text is broken down. It's four books with varying chapters in them. So what we've been reading from is chapter 3, Ball Games, of book 2, Rural Exercises Generally Practiced. Book 3, Pastimes Usually Exercised in Towns and Cities or Places Adjoining to Them, has a ton of chapters. To list them quickly, we've got martial tournaments, plays, bards and minstrels, jesters, dancing, which is pictured here. I don't know if you want to do any descriptions here.
The dancing. I have some questions about the dancing.
Yeah, me too.
So on the left, we have, it looks like one person, they look like they're standing on the other one's shoulders, being held up in the air. And I can't see what the guy on the, is the guy on the right playing an instrument?
I think so. I believe these illustrations, to be fair, might also, like at the bottom it says dancing, leaping, etc. So I think this is maybe covering more than one thing than strictly dancing.
Okay, because it looks like he's either an instrument or like an elaborate dart gun.
I think it's an instrument and he's playing it on stilts.
Oh yeah, I forgot. He's on stilts. Yeah, of course. The middle one, we have two people holding up a ring with like a circus tumbler type situation. It looks like a guy's going to jump through it. And then at the bottom, we have a situation where two guys are holding a long stick, kind of like a limbo type situation. But instead of walking under it, the guy has his knees looped around it and he's sort of hanging off of it. He's very athletic.
Yeah, like there's some gymnastics, acrobatics going on, but instead of just like putting a post up on some, like a crossbar up as a post, it's like, no, you are holding this while mm-hmm. I do flips on it. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, next on the list we have, this is some great images here, animal tricks and training.
I don't want to think about how those animals got to be able to do these things.
No, I mean, I feel like that cock, I guess, is doing a really good job on those stilts, so... I would love to see that.
We have rooster on stilts. We have a bear who's sort of tumbling around. We have looks to be a hare. Is he holding a little drum?
It looks like he's playing a Bowron or some kind of drum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically every one of these, except for maybe the dog kind of like doing the begging motion mm-hmm. for the guy playing the drum. All of these give me the vibe of, oh yeah, somebody definitely told me they saw this in like a different mm-hmm. country, and I'm going to put it down as true.
There's a, is that a monkey wearing a hat who is riding on like a bear cub? Or is that a...
I think it has to be some kind of primate because... Oh, sorry, that one. I thought you meant the one on the left because I was like, well, the one on the left is cheeked up. It has to be some kind of...
all cheeked up on a leash. That sounds like a classic Friday night to me.
Yeah, well, yeah, going back to the beginning of our episode a little bit.
But yeah, definitely. I think it's a monkey in a little hat on, I think it's a, like a bear cub.
Yeah, who fucking knows? Again, people only were just figuring out, like, is it possible to draw an animal with any kind of accuracy? So yeah, the animal training, I think it's worth briefly dipping into this firsthand account from 1670.
And does the caption say talented animals at the bottom?
It says tutored animals.
Tutored animals. Okay, that's more accurate, I would say.
Yeah.
I went with some friends. I'm reading a quote. I'm not telling a personal story here.
No, I think you should tell it like a personal story. Everyone, please imagine this is a personal story.
I actually went with some friends to the bear garden where it was cockfighting, dogfighting, and bear and bull baiting. Mm-hmm. It being famous in the day for all these butcherly sports, or rather barbarous cruelties. One of the bulls tossed a dog full into a lady's lap. Yeah. As she sat in one of the boxes at a considerable height from the arena, two poor dogs were killed. And so all ended with the ape on horseback. And I'm most heartily weary of the rude and dirty pastime, really.
I really need to understand what this transition is. Two poor dogs were killed. And so all ended with the ape on horseback. What do you mean? Please elaborate.
What is the so connection here? Yeah. I guess, is the ape on horseback maybe the go-to finale? So once the two dogs die, okay, we got to wrap this up.
Yeah, I guess so. Probably, honestly. And finally, we have our last chapter in this section, bowling. Get some more images there.
Bowling, here's a good crossover, actually, with Beyond the Breakers. We discussed the game of bowling in our Spanish Armada episode because of the famous and likely apocryphal story of Francis Drake wanting to finish up his game of bowls. Before he, you know, took to the ships to defeat the Spanish Armada.
Yeah, that's basically every story from back then, famous and likely apocryphal.
Mm-hmm. But yes, we have some good depictions of bowling. The guy at the top, he's really busting a move there on the right.
Is this still the dancing page?
It looks like he seems to be like trying to distract the opponent a little bit.
Yeah, that is how I play bocce for sure.
Let's see, the middle we have, it looks like there may be, I don't know, maybe measuring a throw for being how close it is if they're playing this kind of like bocce ball.
It looks like a more polite and respectable version of the top game. And then the bottom, like,
the middle, it's like, okay, you can distract the thrower, but you can only flex at the wrists.
Yeah.
Whereas in the top one, he's going full arm here to distract.
Yeah.
And then in the middle, okay, that has to be illegal. In the middle, you can't do that in the middle of the field. Like,
see, I'm looking at this like, okay, we're looking down the lanes. You know, if I'm imagining what we call bowling today, like 10 pin bowling or 5 pin bowling as a Canadian, I'm like, okay, this is like exactly the pose I make when I release the ball. If you're facing the pins,
it's almost like the Heisman pose for like anyone familiar with American college football. It's the Heisman Trophy pose almost, where they're just sort of like. Just dancing on it.
All right, this section on bowling naturally contains entries for bowling greens, bowling lanes, billiards, and a wide variety of related pastimes. Then, directly after a very dumb game about gambling on coins dropped out of a hat, if anybody is familiar with the very stupid old-timey Australian game of two-up, it's like the exact same energy.
Oh, yeah, I think I only know that because of... What's the movie? The big kangaroo hunt.
Wake and Fright.
Wake and Fright, yeah.
Yes, yes. It is exactly like that. It's just like you're gambling on whether the coins dropped out of a hat will be heads or tails or something. Like how many?
Okay.
Very stupid. And then right after that, cockfighting.
All right.
There's nothing I believe in more strongly than teaching the controversy. So here is one opinion on the matter. It dates to 1614. Quote, "There is no pleasure more noble, delightsome, or void of cousinage and deceit than this pleasure of cocking." Or cousinage? What does that mean? I didn't look it up.
Cousinage sounds like the French euphemism for like incest. it's actually cousinage.
Oh my God. I should not have drank water when you said that. I nearly spit it all over my laptop. Yeah.
Yes, we are going to just engage in a little bit of, how you say, cousinage. Don't worry about it. She's nearly old enough.
So like... I think cousinage honestly just seems like, yeah, like deceit and ignobility, that's cousin shit. Like,
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
On the other hand, we have a description of a particular variant of cockfighting, and this probably deserves a caveat that this has been termed by Strutt as the Welch main, as he cites an unnamed author who calls it a disgrace to us as Englishmen. I'm pretty sure Welch is on the same same level of Scotch in terms of,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely, that one doesn't seem, to me, that one seems like more of a slur than Scotch seems to me. Welch with like the CH seems like intentionally insulting. I don't know why, but it does.
Arguably, I think they both are, but yeah, mm-hmm. That's, I don't think that's a problem that you and I will solve today.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the description of this variant of cockfighting.
Oh no.
Yeah. Honestly, okay, like the first two clauses of the sentence are very funny. To the second comma, and then it becomes not funny.
Yeah. All right. An appropriate mix of humor and sobriety here.
Of course.
"It consists of a certain or given number of pairs of cocks. Suppose 16, which fight with each other until one half of them are killed.
Oh.
The 16 conquerors are pitted a second time in like manner, and half are slain.
Oh.
The 8 survivors a third time, the 4 a fourth time, the remaining 2 a fifth time. So that, quote, 31 cocks are sure to be inhumanly murdered for the sport and pleasure of the spectators."
I hope they mean that in the cock destroyer sense.
Yeah, brother, these cocks are going to be inhumanly murdered by these pussies.
School children at this time were trying to hide their paper brackets from the teacher. They were filling out for the cockfights instead of March Madness.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So like, yeah, there's this quote you read inside the quote. It does not make it clear who he's quoting inside that passage. It's just given in the quotation mark. So who fucking knows?
31 cocks are sure to be inhumanly murdered. Again, that's a Friday night.
Yeah.
Where I come from.
And next up, the aforementioned throwing at cock. So this is Strutt again. I'm going to read this passage. "Sir Thomas More, who wrote in the 16th century describing the state of childhood, speaks of his skill in casting a cock steel, that is, a stick or cudgel to throw at a cock. It was universally practiced upon Shrove Tuesday. If the poor bird by chance had its legs broken or was otherwise so lamed as not to be able to stand, the barbarous owners were wont to support it with sticks in order to prolong the pleasure received from the reiteration of its torment."
Mm.
The magistrates, greatly to their credit, have for some years past put a stop to this wicked custom, and at present, 1800, it is nearly, if not entirely, discontinued in every part of the kingdom. Well, thank goodness for that. Fuck.
So, like, if you were a famous athlete at the time, this is the scandal you'd get caught up in, like a throwing at cocks scandal that, you know, you're now in hot water over.
Yeah, if you're the Michael Vick of lawn bowling.
Michael, but it's spelled with an extra E, and Vick is spelled V-Y-C-K-E.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this discussion of throwing at cocks would not be complete without the comparatively tame version in which the animal is suspended in an earthen vessel, townsfolk would pay to throw objects at with the goal of breaking the pot and claiming the rooster as their prize. Or, in the case of one attested jape...
At North Wall... Is it Walsham or Walsham, I wonder?
I want to say with everything H-A-M kind of just being pronounced A-M, I think it would just be like Walsham or Walsham.
Okay.
I didn't look this one up.
At North Walsham in Norfolk, about 1760, some wags put an owl in one of these vessels, and having procured the head and tail of a dead cock, they placed them in the same position as if they had appertained to a living one. The deception was successful, and at last a laboring man belonging to the town, after several fruitless attempts, broke the pot, but missed his prize. For the owl, being set at liberty, instantly flew away, to his great astonishment, and left him nothing more than the head and tail of the dead bird, with the potsherds, for his money and his trouble. This ridiculous adventure exposed him to the continual laughter of the townspeople, and obliged him to quit the place, to which I'm told he returned no more. Oh, God.
You ever get pranked so hard you have to leave town forever? This idiot thought it was a real cock in the pot. It was an owl, you stupid fuck.
What a dumb bitch. Oh, yeah. My God.
I'm glad you pronounced that pot shards, because when I was looking at it, I thought it was like pots herds, like shepherds or something. And I was like,
pots herds, got to get the pots in.
Yeah. Before dark. Yeah. No, come back. It's just a prank, bro.
Just imagine his wife leaving him. You know, taking the kids because you got pranked so hard.
Yeah. His wife told him, you need to leave town. Sorry, I cannot be seen with you.
There's that, I think you should leave bit with Cecily Strong where he gets made fun of by the magician on stage.
Oh.
It's a good one. But yeah, same thing here. I've never been pranked that hard. I hope I never am.
Well, speaking of Shrove Tuesday, this spot in the Christian calendar is the day before Ash Wednesday, which is when Lent begins. Because people are often giving up on indulgent behaviors for Lent, Shrove Tuesday often becomes tantamount to a feast or a carnival as people get those last indulgences in, which is where it gets nicknames like Fat Tuesday, better known by its French translation.
Mardi Gras.
Yeah. Now, many of these folk ball games, they're strongly tied to Shrovetide, Easter, some observance of the Christian calendar when people would be gathering, right? And this is to the extent that multiple towns still engage in them as an annual tradition even in 2025, going back centuries in some cases with very few interruptions. Notable examples of this include the Royal Ashburn Shrovetide football event, so titled because it received royal recognition in 1922. And now please enjoy the future King Chuck. He's getting carried to go toss out the first ball in 2003. Is this not the most like English picture you've ever seen?
He looks like he like scored the winning goal of the World Cup for England or something, and they're carrying him down the street.
He's getting carried in the same way as we're going to see a guy who actually like gold the ball, as they say.
Mm-hmm. I just looked at the crowd and I'm kind of horrified. Like there's like four people in that crowd and there's just copies of them distributed. Like that's what makes up the there's like four different. I hate to use this word, but physiognomies of guy here in this picture.
Yeah, the four types of lad.
Man, it is just,
the four English genders of male.
It is just blindingly white, this crowd.
Yeah.
I don't think I see a non-white person or a woman anywhere.
No, just lads.
These are all just meat pie fed good old English boys here.
This is the highest density of bloke you will ever encounter.
They're all extremely round.
Yeah, like even the fit ones are round.
They're very like snowman body type, where they're all very round in the torso, very round of head also.
Yeah. Like I love this man just to the right of the the king, the Prince Charles pile here, where he's got like a sweater on, like a knitted sweater.
Yep.
His grandma made him.
It's clearly quite, he's had it for a long time, because I don't think, it doesn't totally fit him anymore. The yeah. bottom of it's a little ragged looking.
Yeah, there is a picture of him wearing this at the age of 15, and he has the exact same like smile.
Oh my God. Same.
Yeah, and they've all linked arms, which is also cute. It's just, there's so much going on. But yeah, note the way they're carrying Charles and the ornateness of the ball he's holding, because that'll briefly come back in part two.
Okay.
And then you have the Atherston ball game, which is every Shrove Tuesday for 825 out of 826 years. Is this not a Renaissance painting if you've ever seen one?
Oh yeah, this is classic. Oh my God. Yeah. A lot more diversity here. I mean, in terms of appearance, you got some beards, you got a lot more hair, a much younger crowd, it looks like.
Yeah, we've got a femme looking person quite close to the middle here.
Mm-hmm.
Next to this man in the blue shirt, who I believe is dead. I also like that some of them are labeled Atherston Ballgame Senior Marshal. Like, these people are kind of refereeing the game, and they look as much as anyone like participants, both mm-hmm. in just like their faces and their actions.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible picture. I mean, I cannot explain this picture to you. You have to see it. So if you're listening, I don't know, I'll post it in our Discord if you want to see it. Unbelievable. Yeah. So 825 out of 826 years straight, they did this. They had previously bragged that they didn't stop when there was a foot and mouth disease outbreak in the UK. Now, they did stop, to their credit, for COVID-19. That was the 1 year.
Okay. I was going to ask, what was the 1 year?
COVID. Yeah.
Okay.
Really, like, I was actually impressed. Out of those 825 year streaks or whatever it was at that time. And just to be clear, there was another, I think it's the Ashburn one, that they're like, yes, we also stopped for foot and mouth disease. So it was like just Atherston that was like, no, we're not stopping.
I do imagine them just like pressing on and doing this anyway for COVID, but everyone is wearing just one of the, just a cheap, a mask.
Yeah. Yeah.
That should do it, right?
Yeah. And then you got the Hallaton, I'm probably saying that wrong, bottle kicking, which actually involves small barrels of beer as the game balls.
Hmm.
This is also a really beautifully composed shot.
This definitely seems like a game that someone came up with drunk and has to be played drunk. No part of this game could be sober, I don't think.
Well, let's continue with the description of this game. So this game with these little barrels starts only after the local vicar blesses a hair pie and, quote, great greasy handfuls of it are thrown into the hungry, scrambling crowd, end quote.
Hmm.
Yeah. Okay. We do not have time to go deeper into this game.
Okay.
Now, mercifully, this expansive hodgepodge of games was eventually subject to arguably the true favorite pastime of Western Europeans, or at the very least, it's one of their most effective and insidious, and that's taxonomy. Today, you can give a few definitions of what constitutes a separate football code, but if we go on the basis that a football code entails its own distinct ball, and different fields or rules with the same ball constitute a variant of the same code, the way I'm choosing to break it down, there are 7 codes of football played worldwide. 2 of them involve spherical balls, while the rest involve prolate spheroids, and only 1 completely prohibits most of its players from using their hands during active play. So my pop quiz for you, can you name all 7, and which one was codified first? And codified, I guess here I'm going to say, meaning it had a set of laws published, like an overarching laws, set of laws published by a governing body, not just one group that was playing amongst themselves.
Okay. So if we're class, these are variants of...
So a football code that has its own distinct ball from other codes, not necessarily, like if you have the same ball, but like different rules or a different field, mm-hmm. that's a variant of the same code.
Okay. So we've got football, like association football, like soccer.
Yeah, that's one.
Rugby.
Okay.
So like the two variants or the two main variants of rugby wouldn't count as two different games because it's just the same game, right?
It would, because they have slightly different balls.
Oh, okay.
So that's 3.
There's what is it? I forget the names of the two of them.
They're rugby union and rugby league.
Okay. Rugby union, rugby league. Okay. So we're at 3. Would American football be counting in this?
Mm-hmm.
Handball?
No.
Okay.
I'm confident in saying handball is not football.
Okay. Well, again, I'm American. You never know.
Yeah.
Australian rules football.
Mm-hmm. You got 2 left.
Is it Gaelic football? Do they use a similar ball?
Yeah.
I'm...
This is so rude to me personally that you don't know the 7th code.
7th code. The seventh code of football. Oh, Canadian football.
There you go. You nailed it.
Okay. Well, with the...
Yeah, spoilers.
Oh, no.
We'll get to that.
That one, because it's so similar in like mechanically to American football, I totally forget. Oh, it is, you know, a different game.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it depends on how you want to break down what a code is. I picked a very convenient set of criteria for me that allowed me to acknowledge Canadian football, but not arena football, which is played with an American football, but in a smaller field.
Right.
Or even anything like rugby sevens, which is a variant of rugby union. But these, I'm not pulling that out of my ass completely, because one of the sources that I have that does a breakdown of the seven variants, like it has a chapter for each of the seven, if not more chapters. Yeah, not completely talking out of my ass, but that's a way of breaking it down. But which one do you think was codified first?
Codified first, I would say rugby union.
Okay, we will come back to your answer later. You may find yourself surprised.
All right.
So my overarching goal with this series is to explore one of these variants, and you'll never guess which one. And we're going to begin exploring the reasons we got such wildly different games with the same name in part two. But for now, do you want to give one more quick plug for your show and we will get out of here?
Sure. I'm Tanner. I am from a podcast called Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. We are on all the normal social medias. We're on Instagram, Blue Sky, Twitter. X the everything app. We're on all those, so give us a follow. We are somewhat active on those, and then we put out an episode every 1 to 2 weeks, depends on the time. Yeah, if you're interested in shipwrecks or history related to maritime incidents, give us a listen.
And yeah, if you're listening to this show is Canuck as a Slur, and we have a Patreon, patreon.com/CanuckasASlur. You get bonus episodes if you support us. And one thing I always forget, leave a review. I was not doing that for podcasts because I'm like, that sounds like a lot of work. And I don't know what app you use, but in Pocket Casts, literally you can just go, like you just open up the thing in Pocket Casts, you open up your podcast you're listening to and you just tap 5 stars. Bam. It actually apparently helps with like algorithms in certain places. So I've never discovered a podcast through Discovery, but every little thing helps. So yeah, other than that, all of our links you'll find in the description, our Instagram, our Blue Sky. I think I've officially decided I'm not even going to post on X the Everything app anymore because it is like just too structurally evil. And Instagram, Blue Sky, Patreon, those are the main links I would love to check out. And our Discord if you want to jump in and hang out with us and argue about, what is and is not Scotland. Mm-hmm. That's all we have for today. And yeah, just until next time. Please don't play sports with knives. Any sports, I'm going to just confidently say. I don't think there's any sports you should play with knives. Tanner, do you want to say our sign-off?
Je m'en calisse.
Beautiful. Canuck is a Slur is an independent, collaborative effort to present a critical, progressive perspective on Canadian history and culture. Drop them. To make consistent, high-quality content, we need your support. Head on over to patreon.com/CanuckIsASlur to sign up. Beauty. If you're still on the fence, well, here's the sales pitch. Patrons at the good old Canadian boy level unlock expanded access to our Discord server, including sneak peeks at upcoming episodes. Let's go! Patrons at the good old Ontario boy level will also get into our archive of bonus content, which includes an extra episode every month. Patrons at the good old Kingston boy level get to commission a free piece of bad art every month as well, in addition to further special Discord privileges. Oh, how she loves the Stanley Cup. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go. Listen to what I say. Play that game the Canadian way. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go. We'd love for you to come and follow us on our various socials, which you can find linked in the episode description. You can also see any further links for our guests and co-hosts there as well. The creators of this work would like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples across the continent that had their homes stolen, land broken up by arbitrary borders, cultures suppressed, languages banned, children kidnapped, and who were subjected to many other forms of colonial violence. We also acknowledge the many treaties broken and still unceded territories across Turtle Island. Thanks for listening, eat the rich, and happy trails to you.